Welcome to the Packet Pushers Podcast, a show about data networking, and today we're going to jump in with a show about how to document a network, which has been a popular topic anytime it comes up in the Packet Pushers community. We've had some bloggers write about it, I've written about it, Greg, you've written about it. It's
I don't know about writing about it. I'm not sure about that. Normally it's just a bar coaster. You know, like at a bar, we just write on the back of a beer coaster?
Yeah.
No. Or on a napkin at, like, you know, Hard Rock Cafe or something like that.
What are you telling me? You're telling me the network secrets of the world reside on barroom napkins that you scribbled upon?
I did actually write on one of those linen napkins once. But that was a customer who really wanted to spend a lot of money, so I thought putting it on linen was a real stylish move.
Joining us today is a guest, Dominic, who's been on the show a couple of times before, and he is at least slightly anonymous. Dominic, would you introduce yourself to the Packet Pushers audience?
Hi, I'm Dominic from Berlin. We recorded two shows already, 205 and 210, and right after the recording of show 205, Open Source Network Monitoring, we thought it was a good idea to make a show about documentation.
And all these weeks later, here we are to have this show. So let's just jump right in with kind of a good introductory idea here. Why is it a good idea to have proper documentation? Why even bother with this? And we're talking about this in the context of networking. Why is this a good idea? Dominic, what's your take on that?
Yeah, I would start with a little story. I worked as an external consultant and arrived at many customer sites, and the people, normally the first thing you ask, can I see the documentation to get an overview at the network? And then you often see a long quiet, nothing happens, and then the people have to admit, yeah, we really have no documentation at all.
Yeah, it's not a high priority for us.
And that happens many, many times. And I think in the moment where something breaks, and you don't know what happens, and you start figuring out how is your network connected and start all those little details, I think in this moment you really need a good documentation, yeah? And it is not a good idea to make the documentation in the moment when something breaks, yeah?
So you're saying it's not good enough just to have the entire network in my head, which is pretty normal.
I think there's some practical things there, Ethan, is that at some point somebody from outside will come in. You can't do everything and be everything. Now, whether that's a, you know, expert on, you know, proxy firewalls or a next generation network design and they bring in a contractor, or even at a fundamental level, you want to bring in someone who's going to take the work off you during the day while you go off to do something exciting. So my motto for a lot of things has always been, if you can't be replaced, you can't be promoted. Right. So if you've got no documentation, you can't get somebody to replace you as the guy who SSSH is into the routers if you haven't given them something to start with. You can't get somebody in to help you out if you haven't got something to teach them with or to give them the information they need to survive.
Yeah, that's a really good point. You said that before. If you can't be replaced, you can't be promoted. So, yeah, you want to do your job effectively, but not to the point where you could never, ever possibly leave that position. Mm. And so documentation is a key to enabling someone else to take on the role that you've been doing so effectively for so long.
And it's also a guilt-free exit. So if you're working for a company and you find a better offer, if your documentation's there and it's up to date, then you can quit and walk away knowing that you haven't left them in the lurch because all the documentation's there.
So there's plenty of good reasons to have good documentation. You have it for those cases of troubleshooting. Oh, you have it for other people.
There's one more. I just thought of one more. Ethan.
Oh, and Greg's going to add one more.
If you're going for an interview for that other job, having good documentation is a way of showing what you've done.
That is a good point.
It's funny you put it that way because one of my default interview questions is kind of related to that. It's grab a marker, go up to the whiteboard, and show me a network that you've worked on, which is basically documentation. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And having that documentation, maybe you could print it out, but you can't leave it behind because it might be confidential. But you could show it to somebody and say, look, this is the network documentation that I wrote, or, you know, whatever it is, and then having that to show as part of your interview process is actually quite a valuable thing.
I know documentation is not always the most popular job. Yeah, some people really want to do some installations or bring new boxes in, and documentation stops you sometimes here in this process. But I think do it during the rollout, and then you have the documentation, not do it afterwards, because most of the times you will never do it. Yeah.
Yeah. Documentation to me has become part of my standard rollout process. So if I'm putting something new in place, I've got existing documentation that I'm working from, and then I'm updating the documentation with a lot of times I'll create a proposed document, or if it says Visio, I'll put a tab at the bottom that says proposed. And as configurations are being built or suggested, I'll build out what the new topology is going to look like. And then that proposed becomes final when the change happens. You do the maintenance window, the new system that you propose is now in production, and your documentation is done. It's all right there, and you've already written it. If it's complex, I don't know how you actually do a change without documentation like that anyway. You know, say you're doing a significant router migration, or you're adding a new routing protocol to the environment. You've got to have those documents to look to. As soon as you get into things like 2, 3, 4 routers in a mesh topology, and you're building a lot of adjacencies for redundancy, you can't keep straight all the VLANs and all the little /30s you might be building, et cetera, for such a network without documentation. It gets hopelessly confusing.
And it's so much easier when you see in a Visio, okay, this router has not enough ports, instead seeing that at 3 o'clock in the morning when you try and to plug in another cable, yeah?
So we got lots of good reasons to have documentation. I think another question worth asking here is, who are you documenting for? Because each audience is going to result in a different sort of documentation. Now, for me, the first and foremost person that I'm documenting for is me. So the documentation that I'm building is so that 6 months later, when I haven't thought much about this particular environment, I can pull out the documentation and go, oh yeah, I remember building this thing. And so things like a complex DMZ that maybe has a load balancer and or a proxy server and some other hosts in there with a firewall or a couple of firewalls, and it's kind of a big hairy rat's nest of forwarding and rules and filtering and VLANs and so on. If you're looking at it from the outside, you're just going, I don't remember what all this was. I'm really confused. You can look at something that's been documented and go, oh, yeah, it's all coming back to me now. So that's the first kind of a person that I document for.
That's a key issue to think about is a lot of people get stuck on documentation and say, well, who am I writing it for or what am I doing? One of the best things to do is to just get documenting. You don't need to go and see somebody else's. You don't let anything stop you from documenting the first time. Because nothing stops you from saying that documentation is bad, do it again, as you learn lessons from the one you go before. And there's no right way to do documentation.
And there are so many different IT departments document different things. Yeah, so a network documentation will always look very different from a storage documentation. Yeah,
but it's useful. That's another audience that you could be writing for, actually, are other IT teams. So yes, a network document is going to look very different from a storage document or, say, an application architecture document. But all of those documents can work together to present a complete picture of how IT is delivering a service for a business. And so that's another audience that I'll write for, is I've had to build network diagrams to be related to, say, how we deliver Microsoft Exchange in this environment, or how we deliver SharePoint services in this environment. Everyone will contribute some sort of architecture diagram, and I've contributed network diagrams just for that. Then there's third parties. They like Dominic or Guy, I don't know, one of you guys said something to the effect of, "Hey, can I look at your network document?" What document? So there's I've kind of gotten in the habit of building a scrubbed high level diagram of an environment. Not a lot of IP address information necessarily, but just kind of a big, shows you the sites, shows you the interconnection points, maybe shows you carrier information, you know, these kind of things, so that a vendor could look and go, oh, okay, I kind of get how their network is laid out. It could be more technically detailed if necessary. Maybe you're bringing in, oh, a new network provider, and they are expected to do some work for you to integrate their stuff into your network. You may need to provide them more detail. And then, of course, there's end customers, people that are going to be using your network. They may want to know, well, if I'm going to use your network, I need to know that it's resilient and it will fail over and it's, you know, got pops in all the places I need them and so on. And you can build a document for those kind of people too.
So, yeah, what you're touching on there is a very relevant point. You need a high-level diagram, something that gives you an overview. Like, and I think that actually the overview diagram needs to happen at different levels. One of them is physical. Like if you're looking at the WAN, what's the approximate map of all the sites and how are they connected? You know, like draw a line from the head office to the branch office and stuff like that. In a data center, that would be a rough diagram that might include, is not really an IP-centric or a MAC-centric or a VLAN-centric. It'd be a combination of these devices, this VLAN. It could be, there's no right way to draw a diagram like that, but it needs to be a rough overview. So somebody comes in, looks at that, says, hey, I can see your rough sort of, you know, are you using a tree architecture, spanning tree-based architecture in the data center? Okay, great. Does your WAN hub and spoke, or is it multi-point? You know, what's the branch? What's the MPLS circuits look like? Or if you're doing a diagram of the DMZ, you know, how's that look? Where's the flows? What are the routing, you know, that sort of stuff. Now, a lot of people say to me, you know, should I just do one diagram which is all IP and another one which is all VLANs? And in there, that doesn't actually work because IP addresses and VLANs are actually the same thing today. Not always, but today. And the switches themselves or the routers might have HSRP. So you need to show the VLAN attached to a physical device where the IP address is being routed. So you don't – a high-level diagram and a low-level diagram isn't the same thing for all people, and it's not the same thing for all areas of your network, if that makes sense.
I would add to that, if you have a high-level and a low-level, it's a good idea to have one, let's say, layout and then yep. different layers. The first layer maybe you can present to your managers, yeah, it has some clouds inside and so on. And then if you get to more details, you just put in the other layers of your documentation, but you're always looking at the same document so that you only put in the information that you needed for a specific detail, yeah. To put everything in one gigantic Visio is not a good idea. I've seen that, and nobody really. If you put too much things in one documentation, you don't know what is the detail, what I am looking for, and so on. I'm more a fan of having different layers and just showing what you need at one time.
So I've done some diagrams like this, and my strategy has been not. I think we've all tried at one point in the past to build the huge diagram that's printed on a plotter and you hang it on the wall and it's very impressive and so
on. Good fun.
it's glorious and you really feel awesome when you get it done and it rolls off the print and you tack that sucker up on the wall, you know, and it's 4 feet by 5 feet or whatever it is. It's this monster, right? But then you got to maintain the stupid thing. It's kind of hard to find stuff. It's super impractical to use on the screen, which is where you're going to refer to it most of the time. You're not really going to look at the thing on the wall because it's outdated as soon as you print it.
And how many companies have plotters these days?
So exactly. It's less common than it was for sure.
I mean, I don't have a printer at home, as I discovered when I had to print out a form for a government thing this week. I had to go and buy a new printer.
but for my strategy has been, Dominic, you're talking about layers. I've used a lot of tabs. Now, when you say layers, are you talking layers like layering via checkboxes, more things on top of the same diagram? Or are you talking about, you know, like different diagrams that just have different layers of the network?
No, I mean both. Different tabs. And in each tab, you can do, for example, in Visio, you can do different layouts. So I want to see my physical network, and then I want to see what kind of layer 3 protocol do we have, and then you want to see, okay, which kind of VRF configuration and MPLS we have, and you put it all on the same diagram, and then you just put in the informations with a button that you would like to see, yeah? That is like the Photoshop idea, yeah?
Yeah, and I've ended up with really two sets of diagrams. We're kind of talking about how these high-level and then low-level diagrams. So, yeah, high-level diagrams are easier to maintain. It can give you a lot of good information. different, again, my strategy, different tabs for more specific low-level information. And then, you know, it gets into all the specific details. And I guess the question then becomes, if you're listening to this, how many details do you include? I mean, I like to include on more low-level diagrams. You can get vendor-specific. I like to be location or site-specific. I really think in terms of sites. What's the network like at this site? Because usually there's this self-contained network that then connects off via a WAN pipe or via an internet pipe and a tunnel, whatever it is, to something else. And so there's an obvious division in between that network and other sections of the network in that way. So it's kind of easy to break up the diagram there. And then you can get specific down to very specific networks or, like Dominic was mentioning, different routing protocols and so on. Although I'll argue if you get too detailed, you're inviting so much frustration into your life, because if your network changes a lot, which your network probably changes a little bit every week or every month anyway, it's kind of hopeless to be trying to keep up with your documentation for every little change that you make. Inevitably, documentation seems to get out of date, and the more detail you put into a diagram, the more likely it is it's going to get out of date. So I think there's a law of diminishing returns there. I mean, would you document the MAC address of every host in your network and keep it on a diagram? I mean, that's insanity. You could do it, but it's crazy. That stuff changes too much.
Yeah, and I just want to add, to have a diagram for every site, I also think is a good idea. Besides the technical information, you have things like, who's the on-site technician that I can call if I have a power failure, and how is the site connected, and all these little details. What is the number of the main data center, in which room is it located, or something like that, yeah? So that you put in some additional informations that are site-specific for each site that you have to manage, yeah?
I don't go with that. I don't like doing diagrams for branch offices, because I don't think there's enough information that it actually needs a diagram. I think a spreadsheet is enough. So you can always in Visio, for example, have a spreadsheet. And when you click on the Visio icon, it opens up a spreadsheet and takes you to a point. And you might want to consider investigating how to do that. To me, a spreadsheet is a much more natural place to say, you know, I have an office in Frankfurt. I need to know its address, its phone number, its contact point. I need to know the serial number of the devices there. For most networks, having that in a spreadsheet makes more sense, or even better, in a wiki. But, you know, you can argue about that, rather than having it in a diagram, which is harder to keep up to date. And more importantly, can't delegate a diagram to an administrative person.
The only point I would add to that is I think that model works really well, what you just described, if you've got a large enterprise where the branches are reliably cookie cutter. If you're in a smaller shop where maybe the way the company grew was through acquisition, and so you've got a lot of small companies that are now joined together, well, yeah. Guess what? Every network's a snowflake now, because you don't know what you inherited when the mergers happened. And so in that specific case, I found it's better to actually have the individual diagrams as you try to standardize every office over time, which of course is always budget constrained, so it takes a while.
Yeah, you being the main budget constraint.
Yeah.
Because it's only you, not more yeah. of you.
But at the end of the day, you need the information. If you have a power outage, who is the guy I'm calling? Yeah. If it is in a spreadsheet or in the Visio, that is not so important for me. For me, it's important that you have documented this information that you need. Maybe 3 o'clock in the morning, yeah.
Well, let me ask you guys a question. Where do you draw the line on how much you will document and how much you won't? Or maybe the bigger question is, what should be documented? I mean, we wrote down a bunch of ideas here in the Google Sheet that we're working from. How do you make the call on, too much, I'm not going to document this thing anymore?
I would start with general information. I would say you need two concepts, the high-level concept and the low-level concept. On the high-level side, you have general information that apply to all your sites, to all your networks. Let's say we want redundant network core in each site. Yeah, informations like that are not have a deep detail level, but it is given to build the network, it must have redundant core. Yeah, and on the low level side, you would add more specific informations which apply to each site, to each vendor, with a command that have to be issued, and so on. I think these two kinds of concepts give you the freedom to have multi-vendors and multi-sites, that this is still manageable. Yeah.
So what is your goal in doing that sort of a diagram? Do you want to look at the diagram and understand, like, basically packet flow? If I'm going from this endpoint to this endpoint through this infrastructure, this is how my traffic is going to flow? What are you trying to achieve there?
I would say I need all the informations at different levels. If I have, let's say, troubleshooting hunt, for sure I need the information to get the traffic flow. But as mentioned earlier, we also need the high-level concept only to do, let's say, planning on the new site or other information. It's really depending what you are dealing with. Yeah, and I would say, at the lowest level, if you have a trouble ticket and you need to investigate something, you need that specific information. How is this switch connected? I only do documentation until the switch level. I would not document all the, let's say, connected edge devices in a Visio document or something like that. This is something that I would put in a database. Yeah.
So I would say that there's two ways of approaching the documentation you want to achieve. And I think the one that most people need to work on is documenting intent, or this is what I intend my network to look like, or this is how I want to see the network. So finding a way to capture the information that shows another engineer how the network works. So in the data center, it shows you where the core switches are, where the edge switches are. And, you know, you show two switches at the top of the tree and the fan out, the distribution, the access layers and so forth. That's the information. That's the structural intent of how the network works. Documenting every single thing is usually just a waste of time and money. So, you know, lists of IP addresses, VLAN IDs, nice to have, but hard to maintain and ultimately valueless because it often changes constantly. And in the modern era, as we move towards things like SDN or network management stations like Cisco Prime or, you know, any of the other network management tools, you can get VLAN lists out of a graphical console far easier than you manually typing them into a spreadsheet.
Yeah, you just hit on something really, really important there, which is there's a difference between the documentation you did a week ago and the way the network looks today. And So the most current documentation you have is logging into equipment and taking a look at what's actually there in the configuration. What OSPF adjacencies are up? What is your bridging table look like right now? Where is spanning tree root? And a lot of this stuff may not change a lot, but you know, if you logged in, you're seeing what's current. If you're looking at a piece of paper or a diagram that had been formed in some way, it was accurate at that point in time, presumably. Mm. But has somewhat changed. And so anything that can, whether it's you at the CLI or it's a new graphical tool, you know, an SDN analytics engine that's pulling data in real time off of the network, that's going to give you what the current state of the network really is.
Yeah, you have to be conscious of the cost of documentation against the value that it brings back. So, you know, documenting the MAC address of every single device in your network, whether switch or router or, you know, workstation, has almost no value overall. The only way it's valuable to you is if the cost of collecting every MAC address in your network is low. And the only way to do that is to use a software platform, a SolarWinds or something like that, right? Mm. So manual configuration. The trick is to find high-value concepts of the network that are useful in terms of someone coming into your network. What's the first question they're going to ask you? What brand of switches have you got? Then they're going to ask you, how is it connected? Is it a tree? Is it a fabric path? Is it a Trill implementation? Is it an ECMP? You know, whatever it is, knock yourself out. Go and, you know, just as long as you've got a diagram to capture. And then what's the next thing? Well, what's the SSH address of every console? If you're running them all via CLI, you need that. So the diagram needs to have switch name, and then the address that you're going to SSH to for in-band and out-of-band, right?
Yep.
That's all you need for most diagrams because everything else is SSH in, show run, you know, show IP root. Now, of course, what does show IP root or show spanning tree mean? Well, that's harder to document.
This is a good segue into another section here that we want to talk about, which are a series of tools. What tools can you use to document? And it's a good segue because I think self-documentation is one of the keys. So some things that I have done when configuring devices to make it easier for me to review these later on, interface descriptions. It's a simple thing. Most people don't do it, or they don't do it well, or they do it ambiguously. So after a few weeks, you have no idea what that word meant. it's a server name maybe, or it's you don't really know what it is. You know, come up with a useful description for that interface. So for interface links, you might say what's on the other side of that link, or it's a WAN circuit ID, or it uplinks to a server, or what's the IP address of that server, who manages that server. You know, these are things that you can put into the description field that are really helpful later on and show up in places like SNMP network management stations that can query that interface, and then it'll show you right on the console how that interface has been described. You can name things in an intelligent way, like access lists. Give the access list a name that means something. Don't call it 101 or I will find you and kill you. give it a name. You know, tell me what the stupid thing is for. And
don't use underscores. My favorite peeve, you know, obviously other than give it a number, is don't use underscores because they are really painful to type.
What?
Yeah. That's my pet peeve.
Yeah.
If you're going to give an access a name, I can press dash much easier than I can press shift underscore.
So that appropriately naming objects is – it's not just a Cisco CLI. It's any CLI, or it's in a firewall policy. You know, name objects in a way that accurately describes what they are, and name policy sections in a name that's meaningful. You know, just please, these are easy things to do, and if you don't do it, it's just laziness. You know, come up with a way to make it happen.
Well, device names should be DNS names, true?
If at all possible, yes. And that's a really good habit because that helps with things like trace routes, because you get a reverse DNS lookup out of that if you're maintaining your inadder.arpa domain. Yeah, that could be great.
I'm not going to have an argument with you about naming conventions.
No, I don't. Just agree on something and stick with it. That'd be good. But even without a naming convention, naming it something intelligent is better than not at all, because you get too hung up on, well, I think character 15 needs to be a separator. That's really important. That's, you know, oh gosh, I've been in those conversations too.
Sorry, Dominic, bike shedding at a twist.
Yeah, Donald is not reachable. Can anybody help me? I would say really important is it that you know which tool is good for which information. Yeah, as we argued before, to keep all the MAC addresses in a Visio sheet makes absolutely no sense. But maybe a NAC tool can automate that, and you have a really good history which MAC was on which port shown, and you have a history over years, and this is stored in a nice database. So here it is important to know which information belongs to which database. For an example, the VLAN documentation. I like to do VLAN documentations in an IPAM, IP address management solution, so that you have each IP address gets in VLAN and you know the combination of the two, yeah? And it always has to be rolled out and it always has to be registered in the DNS, so it makes sense, like it is done with InfoBlocks, to have IPAM and DNS synchronized so that you only put it on and you have the documentation in the same moment that you roll out a new IP network. Yeah.
But to speak to your higher point, you're making the point here that there's use the right tool for the job, whatever segment of the network that you're documenting. Not, again, Visio is not the right tool to do all the things when you've got these other tools that can more accurately deal with things like inventory or can integrate DNS with IPAM. And give you a much more effective tool for managing those sorts of intricate details like addressing.
Yeah, and you see, Visio is often over. People try to put too much information into Visio. Yeah, to know, okay, I cannot bring in here all the MAC addresses of my network. That makes no sense. To have this distinction, okay, for that I need an other tool. Yeah, and to know which is the right tool for which job. This is really important. Yep. And as we mentioned earlier, besides Visio, there are so many other tools with a specific information inside. I started with IP address management. Besides that, I also think it is a neat thing to have a cable management tool.
Well, let's walk through these one at a time, because I think we got several categories of applications and tools that we can talk through. And let's start at the top with the thing that most of us use, or most of us think of when we think of network documentation, which is network diagramming, but using icons and connecting them together with lines and putting labels on them to give a visual representation of the network. And of course, Microsoft Visio is the tool that most of us have had the fortune or misfortune of using, all depending on your perspective. Now, I think I'm going to guess most of you here are very familiar with Visio, you know, listening to this show. You've used it in some form or another. And, you know, God bless you and God help you, you know, all at the same time. It's a wonderful, powerful tool that makes me want to kill myself all at the same time.
Visio?
Oh, yes.
I'm so done with Visio. It's a stinking program to use for diagrams. It's the worst possible thing you can use.
You've really gone crazy with OmniGraffle, right?
I use OmniGraffle on the Mac only because – but even on Visio, the biggest thing I have with Visio is people using vendor icons. What do they call them? Templates? Shapes? Shape libraries.
Mm-hmm.
And then wasting hours and hours picking out the Nexus 7000 and then dropping in the module. And, like, who cares? Who gives a rat's
I used to do that, and I've gone to just shapes. It's a box is all it is.
Yeah. And if you're really, really fancy, put a board around the outside of it and use a fancy color. But otherwise, stop wasting my money. Like as a network architect or a designer, I just draw boxes and a line joining them together, and I'm done. If you really want to know how I draw diagrams, I actually wrote an ebook on it that you can buy. It's about $10 on LeanPub. It's open source, free to use it, and you can find out my method. But a box and a line, you can work out how to draw multiple connectors on a single box using Control F9 and just bang, 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 the connector lines around. No more shape libraries. Waste of time. You're wasting away your employer's money, and your life is too short. You know what you could be doing instead of dragging miserably Visio shape templates onto something? You could be down at the pub drinking or having a good time. Really? Really get upset about that. Okay, just go.
I'm not agree with you. I think it is sometimes a good idea, it is depending on the diagram, but to have a general idea how a box looks like, that you can find it in a rec.
No, there's never an excuse for using vendor-shaped templates.
Well, let the man make his point. So Dominic, you're saying you do use the vendor shapes, or do you like, you know, the specific switch icon that represents, you know, a Nexus 7000 or something like that?
I use both. It is depending on which use case, yeah? But to have, for example, a rec where you can see all your boxes, how they really look, makes also sense in some documentation, so that maybe you can find your box, or you know, okay, this box have 8 line cards.
But okay, we're talking about a different use case, and the use case we're describing here is rack management, where you need to know in rack unit, you know, 19 is the topmost rack unit of this particular switch or something like that.
Yeah, for example, and I'm not so sure. I also stick with symbolic icons in most of the cases, but for some places it is not the worst idea to know how the box look like and how many maybe ports or which kind of interfaces it has. No.
Yeah, I get you.
Mm, that's what cameras are for. Take a photo of it.
I've done a lot of that too, actually. Just snap a shot. You can embed it as a JPEG.
So 10 years ago when I started, I would have agreed with you. You know, having the layout helped you identify the box. But in 2015, everybody's got a smartphone that can take photos. There's no excuse for not taking a photo of everything about top, bottom, left, right, up, down, whatever you like. I mean, I can even remember 8, 9 years ago, we used to walk around with special cameras with floppy disk drives in them and take photos of a completed deployment as part of the handover documentation. You just take a photo. And stop wasting your life with pointless Visio shape templates that nobody cares about. Because what happens is within a year or two, you're going to replace something. Maybe you're going to replace that switch. Does that mean that in Visio, which is a miserable environment to be in, and here's why Visio is so miserable. If you want to change that shape template, let's say you've upgraded from a CAT 6500 to a Nexus 7000, you can't just change the shape template or the shape icon. You actually have to delete every single connector, put the new shape in, and then drag every new one onto the thing. How much mistakes and errors can you cause by doing that?
I've done that exact thing you're describing. I shut my eyes and squinted, and I wasn't even thinking that. It just happened as an involuntary reaction to what you were describing, because I've had that happen to me so many times.
And do you think when you're finished that diagram is 100% accurate? Let's say Nexus, you know, you're talking maybe 120 cables coming out of that switch. And every one of those has to be exactly in the right place. You probably spent years getting the other one accurate. It's just a waste of time. You don't need to do that.
I agree that it is a waste of time to make every single interface with a to the right point and stick it to the next access switch. This is really a waste of time. But have the diagram and have a put it out and put it in. It's only a few seconds, and I think then in a symbolic Visio documentation, you need to put in what kind of devices for each device. Then you have to say, okay, this is an Catalyst 6500 on and yeah. the revision and so on. That information is not needed if you use a specific icon. Yeah.
Well, I mean, the thing is you need to capture key information. So if you have two boxes, say one's yellow and one's red, you draw a line between it, and that's two big – that's your core switches together, right? So on top of the line, you can always put interface numbers, IP address, subnets, you know, add a tag about call out that says runs via cabling tray such and such, or maybe have a separate diagram that's got cabling information. You don't need to try and get everything onto one diagram, and certainly Visio shapes are just a misery to use every day.
Well, okay, so we've talked about Visio. We mentioned OmniGraph for the Mac, which is a Visio-like product. Yeah. Now, there's something I blogged about that's a very simplistic tool that's really more for mind mapping or just kind of exploring ideas called Scapple. It's about $15 from a company called Literature and Latte. If you Google Scapple, you should land on that page and find that, and it's available for Mac and Windows. It's real simple. It lets you draw boxes. It lets you draw lines between the boxes. It lets you do some coloring and some shading and doesn't give you a lot of capability beyond that. But once you get used to it, it's very fast. So if all you're trying to do is a quick and dirty network diagram as a reference or to kind of vet an idea, it's really handy, much faster than anything else that I've used. Also not nearly as powerful as a lot of these other tools, but can be useful in a pinch for some things. And I've actually done more with it than I thought I was going to be able to initially, and then found ways to accomplish some clever things with it, and have used it as to build reference documents for network changes where I had to do a lot of config. I would actually build the diagram of the section of the network I was working on and then paste in code paragraphs that I was going to be executing during the network maintenance window attached to each object, each router or switch that I was making the changes to. It was kind of cool. It worked for me.
Okay. Well, I mean, I'm more of a – I know what you're doing with Scapple because I use Scapple as well sometimes. So I'm not opposed to the Scapple thing. But for me, the Scapple, just a little bit too simplistic. Good for
HLTs. It is limited. Yeah, it is
a bit limited. In OmniGraph, what I've done is I've built up a bunch of shape libraries over time. So I actually have documentation of all of, you know, my boxes, my colored boxes are all pre-prepped and so forth. So I don't have that same problem to the same extent.
Can OmniGraph also do multi-layers?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, cool.
Yeah, that's a very good point. We should talk about multiple layers.
So go ahead, bring out the layer guns.
So layers, one of the things you can do in Visio, certainly in OmniGraph for certain, is you can have multiple layers. So you could have the most common one, say, that I've done a lot of is in the data center. You create a tree, you create the boxes and join them together that shows your core distribution access and put it down. And then you create a layer on top of that, and then you put in MLAG information or your spanning tree, which one's my spanning tree, and then you can put on another layer which has your IP addresses, and then you can have another one which shows maybe you'll want to show what's the flow of data for your Oracle data apps or your this business or your accounting package, and each one of those is a layer, and then you can turn the layer on or off. So clicking on a button will say display layer, not display. So if you want to look at the diagram and say, show me just the IP, click the IP, and you see all the IP addresses. And then you put the flow for the Oracle app over the top, and then you're seeing Oracle flow, Oracle data laid over the top of the IP data over the top of the three things. And that's working with Visio layers.
Mm-hmm.
Or layers in any one of the diagramming apps. There are several. You can do the same thing in Photoshop and blah, blah, blah.
Sure,
Is that what you're talking about, Dominic?
Yeah, also very handy if you have overlay networks, yeah. Also great... Yeah. Think to do this in different layers.
Yeah, because you can have multiple layers for different overlays too. So you might have an overlay set for virtualization, for security segmentation. So in a virtual network, even though you've got these physical switches underneath, you might have different multi-tenancy or things like that. So you can now start to show the tenancy, micro-segmentation, that's the word I'm reaching for. in a micro-segmented network for a modern enterprise, you've got all these different segments, you know, like in the virtualized hypervisor layer, and you might want to show where they sit over the top of the physical network using layers.
Yeah, for virtual firewalls with different virtual systems or for multiple VRFs and then MPLS networks, well, you can do fancy things with layers and they are pretty handy, yeah?
Sure.
So one other tool that I'll mention here that is a web alternative to Visio and OmniGraffle and so on would be draw.io. It integrates with Google Drive, so if you're a Google Drive user like I am, I think it also integrates with Dropbox and a few other things to save your documents. Draw.io is pretty great, and it's got a lot of power. And I've made some documents that I recently used in some webinars and so on. And it is actually, now that I think about it, my current favorite, because I don't want to use Visio. I don't really want to spend the money on OmniGraffle because it's a bit of a bear to get your head around. I've spent a little bit of time with a demo of it. Draw.io is pretty intuitive, and there's a lot there and a pretty robust icon library. So I'll recommend that as something definitely worth trying.
All your drawings are in the cloud, yeah?
You can download them locally. You can or save them to your Google Drive, which you can then sync locally as well. But yes, they're effectively you're working in the cloud. So if working offline is a big deal to you, maybe draw.io is not a great answer for you. Although, boy, something in the back of my head says there's some kind of an offline engine where you can work with it offline now that I think about it. I've forgotten. I'll have to dig into that.
One of the Google Docs plugins. There's a couple of diagramming tools associated with Google Docs, I think, and then some of them allow you to work offline, pseudo offline.
Okay, so we talked about self-documentation, name things appropriately. We've talked about diagramming applications, Visio, OmniGraffle, Scapel, Draw.io. What about cable management tools? And Dominic, this is something that you'd put in here. What are your favorite cable management tools?
Yeah, in my current organization, we have kind of a standard that is pretty high. We give every cable that is rolled out a special number. It has a unique number. And it has the number will be documented in our cable management tool. And then you have to put in on the cable a little sticker with the start and the ending point of the cable and then the cable number so that it is for sure somebody calls you, I have a problem with cable, and then he say the number that you can say, okay, this goes from switch A to B, and you can be sure that he's talking about that cable. Yeah, I have seen different cable management tools in the provider space. If you have a lot of fiber, yeah, it is really needed to track all these fibers and all the cables that you put it in a proper cable management. I've seen different versions, and most of them don't have a good usability. Yeah, that is kind of often a problem. On the other side, but you need that documentation. You need if somebody calls you. If you don't document the right cable, you only document the active components, then it can be, for an example, we have fiber cables that goes over 6 locations on passive infrastructure before it reaches another active component. And to track that, maybe an engineer can be on a site where only passive cabling is, yeah, and then he needs that cable number to identify the right cable, yeah.
Yeah, I worked in a data center where we did not have a central tool for cables, but every cable had to be labeled on every end for its path with very specific information. So you would be in a row, it would be connected to a patch panel that would be connected to an MDF patch panel that would then be connected to another IDF, let's say. And that whole path would be labeled on the cable itself with a vinyl-wrapped, you know, self-adhesive label. So the printer would print your lines of information that told you, you know, a host name and all your cross-connect points and maybe an IP address for a host or something where it was connected to on the other end. Which was, I think we managed to fit that into 4 lines, however we did it. Pretty small type, to be fair. And then the label would wrap around the cable, and then the end, very end of that label was clear. And so it would be a clear protection on top of the printed information. And then you could pull the cable, look at it, and go, okay, this cable is going to, and you'd know, host and then the cross-connect path and, you know, and so on, follow the path through. So it was self-documented in that sense, but a little – it did get a little small to read if you had a lot of cross-connect points, which is what makes that the number or a barcode or something tied back to a central solution more much more practical, really.
That's my least favorite option. The problem is that when you take that cable out, you're now relying on somebody to A, throw the cable away, or B, cut the label off, because the cable actually has the metadata attached to it. And so the cable must be discarded. The solution that I most favored today for cable numbering is that every cable that comes into your data center goes to a cabling person who creates a unique identifier and puts it at both ends of the cable. Doesn't matter what the identifier is, just some number, you know, like start at 100,000 and count up from there. You can have all the labels pre-printed, then you just stick one on and then wrap the clear protector on the outside. And then what happens is you now know, you've now got a unique identifier. So you look at the number, you write down the six digits, you go to the other end of the cable that you're looking for, and if the numbers match, you know that you've got the cable that you want. And then if you take the cable out and reuse it on something else, guess what? Your cabling numbering is still unique. So the point is to know if the cable goes from point A to point B. That's the most important factor of a cable. Any documentation that you now build around it, so if cable number 10169 is connected to ETH23 of core switch such and such, and then the other end of 10169 is connected to server B, that's fine. You record that in a spreadsheet or whatever your favorite thing is. But for me, the most important thing is to have a numbering system for the cables that's completely independent of what the cable is used for, because that then gives false information.
One more point I'll make about cable management stuff. There's a startup company called Fiber Mountain that's got a somewhat different approach to how you do data center switching, and part of their solution is called a glass core. Their whole big idea is you use lots of fiber in your data center to directly connect one rack to another rack and not have an intermediate switch hop in the middle. Like leaf to leaf and not leaf spine leaf is kind of the big idea. We don't need to get into it any more than that, other than to point out part of the Fiber Mountain solution is to have baked intelligence into their fiber optic cross connects. They have modules and cables so that you can tell within the Fiber Mountain solution exactly what cable is plugged in where, and what the, you know, you give their serialization on the cable. And so if there's a cable fault, you know which cable it is. And so, so I say that just to raise an example of there are some very intelligent cabling solutions out there that require no documentation on your part at all. Just plug all the stuff in, look at your console when you're done, and you can see what's what and know right down to the physical cable itself. This is all optical, but right down to the cable itself, what's going on. Kind of interesting tech.
I saw recently a presentation of a rack, of a, let's say, cross-connect rack. It has 1,500 ports in one rack, and they store 4,600 meters of fiber cable in that one rack. And if you don't have a proper documentation for that, you will never find anything. Yeah. So the density is getting so much higher these days on the routers, on the switches, on the passive infrastructure, everywhere. So that is really needed. In the old times, 20 years ago, there at some places you had the network guy, he looks at a cable and say, okay, this goes to server Mickey Mouse, yeah? And these days are over, yeah? We have in one data center size over 10,000 cables, yeah? And nobody can track this manually, yeah? You need a database and a proper documentation which is connected to which, yeah?
Got time for a war story?
Oh, yeah? Sure.
Sure. Okay, so my war story was I once worked with a customer and they were moving out of a data center they'd been in for 20 years. And when they started, I remember looking under the floor and thinking the cables are very close to the tiles underneath. And then I started fishing around. It turned out that the floor, the suspended floor, was 2.5 feet deep. And over 20 years, there was cable was layered on top of each other. They never pulled out any of the cable.
How's that airflow working out?
Well, in Australia, the data centers were all aerated internally. This is 10 or 15 years ago. And it turns out that right down at the bottom of that was thick Ethernet, a 2-inch copper core cable.
Oh,
and
baby.
Then on top of that was all this SNA Twin X, and it was an archaeological dig. But it was a conscious decision in the day to never take the cable out under the floor, was to snip it off and then just shove it under the floor and then keep laying it on. And that's why the floor was 2.5 feet tall. 2.5, they'd actually calculated it. And to this day, it still sits in the back of my mind as one of the weirdest cabling stories I've ever seen in my life.
Oh, that's priceless.
Just to add, I've been in the same situation this year with a data center that was refurbished after 20 years. And we also see all the archaeological cables. Yeah. And on the really deep button, I had a cable that was so thick, I couldn't grab it with two fingers nearly. And it has an IBM label on it.
Yep.
And a very old admin told me that 1 meter of this special cable from IBM was, let's say, $500. Yeah, one meter of cable. And that was 20
great.
Years ago.
Yeah, that no, I remember. Yeah.
For IBM host machines, yeah.
Yes. Yeah, I remember. I'm that old. Thanks. Thanks for reminding me.
Let's move from cable management stuff onto rack management stuff. And Dominic, you listed a few different tools that you've worked with. I think we've all probably worked with some kind of a rack management tool or not. Let's. You mentioned rack tables. What's that one all about?
Yeah, I just want to get an overview. I think it's important if you have a lot of racks, let's say a few hundreds, yeah, you need to track how much space is left in my racks. And for example, I have to put in another Nexus 7K, yeah, and this needs nearly a half rack, yeah. Where do I have enough space for that monster, yeah? And at this point, it is really needed to have a proper documentation about all your racks, how much free space do you have, and another really important thing here is also to track the, besides all the, let's say, active cables, fibers and RJ45, you also need to track the power cables.
Yeah.
Which device is connected to, let's say, unbreakable power supply, or if you have a diesel engine for recovery, you need to track that. I have seen so many locations where nobody has tracked the power cabling, yeah? But I think if you have no power, that is really a bad thing, yeah?
Yeah, or you've got redundant power supplies, both hooked up to the same power bus, and so that power bus goes out. Now you've just lost both your power supplies. What the heck was the point of the redundant power supplies again?
Yeah.
So many of those things get overlooked. That and power load is another thing that a rack management tool, in my experience, is nice if it's tracking. How many amps are you drawing out of that thing? Oh, I'm only drawing 16. You're only trying to get 16. What happens when the rack goes down and the whole thing powers up? You're going to blow that amp load. There's no question about it. Things like that need to be. You know, it's nice if you've got a rack management tool that can track that and maybe also track weight and track heat exhaustion as well, which a lot of that may be how well you're using the tool, whether or not you're tracking those things. But I've certainly been in situations where we can't rack this here. The weight is too much. The floor can't take it. We've got to rack it somewhere else or redistribute some things. Oh, crap. If we'd been tracking that better, maybe we would have known. And, you know, heat's this kind of the same thing. How many BTUs of heat are you trying to exhaust out the back of that rack? Again, going back to density problems, this becomes more and more critical to track as you go along. So those are, in addition to the most obvious elements of tracking your rack units, how many RUs are available in a given pod, and what's in each of those RUs, and can you stack everything one right on top of the other? Do you have to leave a certain amount of blank space for heat management again, or for access, and so on? A good rack management tool is going to help you with all of those things.
Yeah, I've seen different tools by different organizations, but I think the three that are on top of my head are Racktables, RackView, and Qviber. Maybe I tell this one wrong, but the name is a little bit complicated. These are three tools. All of them are open source, and all of them do the job. There are, besides that, I think several commercial tools also available to do that job. Yeah, but as we said before, it is really important here that you document your eggs, yeah, that you have some kind, even if it is only a Visio, you need some kind of documentation for all your racks.
Even if it's just a spreadsheet. I mean, if you really, you know, go on the poor man route, a spreadsheet where each a column is a rack and a row is an "Are you in the rack?" That can be an effective way to track what's going on there. It's not sexy, but it can work. A commercial tool that I've had some time with is APC Infrastructure Manager that will tie in all of your power draw and allow you to map that to a floor plan and racks, so you can keep track of some things that way. Not really good for tracking RUs, I don't think, although it's been a few years since I've used it. I don't think it did that, though, but it was great for all your power distribution throughout the data center into all of your racks, so you could see how much, at a glance, how much load was getting pulled from a given rack in a PDU. Really useful stuff.
So a couple of things on rack management. The first thing is have intelligent power bars in your racks. Absolute must have. Can't have any sort of rack management systems without intelligent power bars where you can – the obvious thing, of course, is that an intelligent power bar can do power on, power off. But good quality power bars will tell you how much power is being drawn through all of the power sockets.
Exactly.
And B, make sure you use the rack, the intelligent power bars, and get them configured with IP addresses and out-of-band cabling, because if you try to do them in-band – and you shut the power off to the switch that's connecting them together, you might have a bit of a problem. So be smart about how you connect them to the network. And the second one is I've seen an increasing tendency for companies. I've been doing some work with high-performance compute, and they've been putting temperature sensors all over their racks. So what is the in-front temperature and the rear temperature of a given rack? And that's becoming increasingly important because as we move into devices that are burning many kilowatts, like, for example, a lot of these modern switches actually exhaust 10 kilowatts of power into a 5RU space and create hotspots at the back of the rack where that gear is. And I've seen situations where the outlet temperature from the networks gets fed into the inlet temperature and causes server failures adjacent to the core switches because the temperature's up by 10 degrees. And the only way to detect that is to have a mat of temperature sensors all the way around your data center showing it up. And as we increase the density of your data centers and thermal loads become important, although I think, you know, over the 10-year time, it would probably be less important as power consumption drops away. But those are sorts of issues you need to start thinking about in rack management. It isn't just about the software. You need to give the software data to be useful to you.
Yeah.
So this is APC infrastructure allows you to bring in temperature sensors and power management and all that sort of stuff into something useful and give you a graphical console so you can decode that.
Yep, absolutely true. All right, so we've talked about diagramming, cable management, rack management, and now a knowledge database of some sort. And this is maybe the thing that resonated the most with me, Dominic, of all the different points that that you raised in this this Google Doc before we started the show. The knowledge base for me is the thing that so I'm trying to remember why in the world did we configure the switch to do this? This is not normal. What that was there was a reason for this, wasn't there? Oh, what was it? The knowledge base. That's where all that information should be. And that can be a lot of different forms. I mean, I've been unfortunate in with some companies to have SharePoint as the blogging tool where I've had to interface with SharePoint to put in information. It works. It's just like the most graceless interface you can imagine. Maybe it's wonderful now. I don't know. I'm using talking about older versions of SharePoint. But you could do that. You could do WordPress, you know, build a blog yourself. You can build simple text documents and keep them in a folder, you know, but something that you can go back to that reminds you.
Wiki is also a very common tool, the Wikimedia web front end. And this is kind of the glue that sticks all the documentations together. Yeah, where you find references. Okay, look at this document or go to the IP database. And I think the knowledge database can be kind of the central, the first point where you hop in, make a quick search, and then you get, we have this documentation on this point, and then you get references here. This is also kind of the, let's say, part for me of the knowledge database. And as you mentioned earlier, all the details, the nitty-gritty details that only were done on one site can be put in here, yeah?
I put all kinds of things into the knowledge base. I love the way you described it as the glue for all the other documentation. So, for example, B2B VPN tunnels. You're connecting to some partner of your company's that's on the other side of the planet because you're doing outsourcing work, let's say. And it took you a long time to get the VPN tunnel to come up because they're a Sonic Wall shop and your Cisco, and there was whatever challenge you had making the IPsec tunnel work. Put it all in the knowledge base. Well, we tried this and this, and then we changed this, and then we set this, and then, you know, it turned out that, you know, the mismatch was thus and so. And so you document all of those things so that the next time you have that problem, because you will, you can go back and refer to that. I've used it for things like, oh, I'm building out a pair of Cisco Nexuses and I need to set up virtual port channel. Well, how did we set that up and how did we test it and how do we know that it's working and, you know, and so on? Oh, weird problem with effects. It's throwing this error message. Oh, well, that error message is the result of thus and so. You just document all that stuff in a knowledge base. Kind of like a lot of you that listen to this show might be bloggers. Yeah, that kind of thing, I guess. That's how many of you use your blogs, I know. But it's great to have – there's only certain things you can put publicly, right, on your blog. If you need something internal to the company that will stay private and not make its way to the public internet, so you can put in all the detailed information that that'll help you solve that problem the next time or get a job done faster the next time you're called upon to do it.
And if everybody starts putting in things here, it is really a team effort, yeah? If you put in a new technology on a new site, let's say I implement shortest path bridging on a new site and you put all the details run into the knowledge base, so maybe the next colleague can refer to that if you have a problem, yeah? And the firewall admins also put something into the knowledge database. Maybe if you are not an expert on the firewalls, you can just put in the knowledge base reference and see, that's how the redundancy is working, let's say, on vendor X or Y. Yeah.
Okay, so knowledge database. I think we're all believers here in that. Let's move on to IP address management. And Dominic, you've got some okay, so I'm sighing because I had a project a while ago to try to come up with some sort of IPAM solution, and I came up with nothing. Having tried about six things and hating all of them for various reasons, in the open source world, I just didn't end up getting anything. So what are your recommendations or, you know, thoughts around IPAM?
Let's say I think the most used IPAM tool is the worst, and that is Excel. That is what I have seen a lot of times. Yeah, people put in the IP addresses into Excel sheets, and that is really horrible. If you sync with
IP, it's better than nothing. Everyone's got it. It's got that going for it. But outside of that, because it's not dynamic, it sucks. Yeah.
If you sync in IPv4 dimensions, maybe one guy can know all the addresses and is doing everything, yeah? But if you only think about an IPv6 deployment, it is absolutely needed to have a proper IPAM, yeah? If you, in an IPv6, our organization, let's say, reserved 2/32 blocks for IPv6, yeah? This cannot be stored in any Excel sheet, yeah? No way of doing that, yeah? And in the provider space, you also have some standards. If you are dealing with a RIPE or other organization, you need an IP address management tool, yeah? And there are some pretty good open source projects. I would only mention here PHP IPAM and NEPUB. Both have a nice web front end and both support IPv6. And on the commercial side, I would say Infoblox and SixConnect are the two big players here that I have seen are used a lot. Yeah, and I particularly like Infoblox because it is, besides IPAM, also DNS and DHCP server. So you have all the three kind of informations put together in one location.
Yeah, you can do a lot with the Infoblox stuff. It's not, IPAM is certainly there, but it does, depending on what modules you buy, it's really powerful. I mean, it can get as granular as giving, if I remember right, I'm going back some time now since I've looked at their product set, but there's a switch port correlator where it could tell you this Mac, this IP address was last seen on this particular switch port, and then really get it right down to that level of detail for you.
I'm not a big Infoblox fan. I think it's overpriced for what you get.
I kind of remember it being really expensive, yeah.
Oh, it's eye-wateringly expensive.
But there is this clustering technology they've got that I think is part of why they try to charge what they charge for it, that lets you distribute all those different services, DNS and DHCP, et cetera, across members of the cluster.
The time and energy that you would save by paying out for a Infoblox product, you'd be better off hiring another headcount against the maintenance price of an Infoblox product.
Man, is it that pricey?
Yeah. You're talking headcount pricey, just for the maintenance, not for the capital purchase. But I would rather have a second network engineer or another network engineer on my team than buy Infoblox, because I would get better productivity out of that. That's an unpopular perspective, but anyway.
There are good open source alternatives, but if your company says we have a lot of money, we don't care. Infoblox is also a good product I can recommend. Yeah.
Increasingly, though, the days of using open source for this type of stuff is becoming the standard. So for the last 10 years, we've been forced to buy branded products like Infoblox and Blue Cat and all that sort of stuff. But as we become more Linux savvy, like we now have permission through DevOps and NetOps to start being Linux people again and write code, it starts to make sense to get into these tools so that you can learn Linux and justify it and say, look, you know, I'm going to spend time on these products, and what you're actually doing is dusting off your Linux skills and learning some DevOps.
Yeah, that's a mindset. It's also it's a time problem too. It's a mindset problem, but it's a time problem. I mean, if you because of what I was saying before, just playing with different IPAM open source tools, I needed something that worked. I didn't need something that I was going to have to put a couple of weeks or even months into to make it work the way we needed it to, or to work reliably, or to not look like a turd that fell out of an ostrich. You know, I needed it to really work and be good immediately. And that's the problem I have with most of the open source projects that are out there.
I'm being I'm being a little sarcastic, right? But you need to get your Linux skill from somewhere. Do it on network management and use some open source software.
I know. I'm just trying to take the opposite perspective of, do I have to take the time to do that? Because I actually agree with you, and it's always rewarding when I put the time in to learn something. But sometimes it's just so much pressure on to get something done, you don't feel like you have that time. And so it's easier to go to an Infoblox, pay there, pack up the wheelbarrow with the gold in it and give it to them, and you come up with a product that's more or less turnkey.
Money, what do you care, right? Unless it's your budget, in which case you do care. If it comes down to the decision. I guess what I'm seeing today is, and what I think with most customers is, they don't actually know what they're buying. So if you look at these other products and you think, oh, I'll buy it and see what it's like, or I don't understand what it is, my advice to people is to go and buy something else first. So buy the cheaper product first, deploy it, learn what doesn't work. So go and deploy PHP, IPAM, and or any of these other open source solutions. There's dozens of them. And then work out what they do, then realize what they don't do, and then go and evaluate these more expensive products and realize if they're fair value for money for your situation. Don't go and buy the most expensive product first, because 98% of customers I've seen that actually have Infoblox or any of these other commercial Blue Cat or whatever, they don't actually use them, because the people don't get the time to load the data into them. So until they become part of your day-to-day workflow, there's no point in buying them.
Yeah, this is a real challenge if you come from 800 Excel sheets to put it all into your central IP address management. Yeah, that is the real challenge. But if you have done that and you have a central interface and you can search across your complete organization or company for every IP address that you are using, this is kind of the position where you would like to be. Yeah.
Now, of the open source tools that you've used, Don, do you have a particular favorite, or are they positioned kind of differently? I mean, you list PHP, IPAM, and NIPAP.
Both are good. I have seen both. I like the NIPAP web interface more than the PHP IPAM interface, but I think both are doing the job good. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, okay then. Diagramming, cable management, rack management, a knowledge base, IPAM, and configuration backup is the next place we're moving to here. And contextually, we're talking about your devices have a configuration that need to be backed up. I would say every time that they change, you need to have a fresh copy of that so that you can do diffs. You can see what's changed between the old and the new configuration so that you have a way to restore and get back to a baseline of functionality if that device tanks on you or there's some kind of a network outage that a change has caused, perhaps. And you need this to be automated. You don't want to have to be manually dealing with configuration backups, because if it's up to you to remember to do it, you won't. So therefore, you need a tool that's going to handle that for you. Rancid has been popular for a long time. A lot of folks have used it. Dominic, what are your thoughts on that one particularly?
Yeah, I've seen beside Rancid also a lot of people using a Perl or Python script, yeah, to do the job. But the important thing is here not only to store all the configuration, put it in a database that is searchable, that makes you the diff from the previous to the next version and all the differences here, that you can do a search across all your configuration, that you don't need to log in into a switch and make a show run. No, you need a centralized web interface that is doing that across all your switches. Yeah, that is something I like.
I agree with that. I'll just throw out a commercial solution that I've used that I'm familiar with that does exactly that. Which is SolarWinds Network Configuration Manager. Full disclosure, SolarWinds has been a sponsor of Packet Pushers before. I just mentioned them because I've used it as a product. And it goes out, and when there's a change to a configuration, it gets that change, it stores it in a database. And then you can get a report, if you wish, of the change that was made between the old and the new, and get a diff right in your email every day if that's what you want. Pretty useful in that regard. Dominic, you mentioned something called Oxidized. I'm not familiar with that one at all.
It's kind of the same than Rancid. Let's say I seen a lot of developers are active here, and I suggest that Rancid is not developed that much more at the moment. Yeah.
Okay, so not a lot of development activity for Rancid, but yeah. Oxidized is the new open source hotness for configuration management. Is that what we're saying? Okay.
Yeah.
Greg, any words of wisdom on configuration stuff?
Use Rancid. It works. Unlike, I've seen a lot of different vendor solutions in different spaces. The thing about Rancid is it's got scripts for every single device you never thought you had. Like, it can even back up HP laser printers and things. And that alone was what makes it most valuable to me, is that ability to be able to everything, you know. And there's not, as you say, there's not a lot of development work for it, and it's the most ugliest, cruftiest thing you've ever seen in your life, but it does work. You can tell me anything you like, but that's what the simple fact is. It works rather marvelously, and there's a lot to be said for that.
Well, we've gone over an hour, and there's a couple of other tools that we want to talk about, so let's move on to them. And these are some interactive tools that let you engage with the network in real time and let you see what's going on. We've got a couple here to discuss. One is NetBrain, and another is NogViz. I'll pronounce it that way. There we go. NogViz. Okay. NetBrain, again, full disclosure, they are a Packet Pushers sponsor. They do some banner ads with us, which is not why we're mentioning them here, but just so that you're aware of that. NetBrain is... It's real-time mapping. It's real-time custom mapping that lets you point to your network and say, show me the OSPF view between these two endpoints, and it'll dynamically create a map that shows you that. I did an eval of NetBrain and spent many hours with it sometime last fall, and just found it to be extraordinarily powerful. I was quite smitten with it. It's not cheap. You will pay really good money for NetBrain. But what it gives you in this, again, dynamic mapping, real-time mapping, it will do things like, on a scheduled basis, go out and document a section of the network for you and export it to Visio on a schedule if you want it to do that. You can have it show you the layer 3 view or the layer 2 view, and it will build a map dynamically. I had this thing discover a small network that had a firewall and a bunch of switches and a bunch of endpoints and some WAPs, and do a wire map of it. And it did it, and I couldn't find any mistakes whatsoever. I mean, it's just pulling all the SNMP data, so it's not like there's any reason it would come up with a mistake. And CDP data, and it can do bridging tables and ARP tables and so on, correlate all of that, and then throw it down into a map. And the default map that it comes up with isn't bad. You can drag things around and make it cleaner and easier to look if you want, and then, like I said, save it, and then have it automatically update that from there. It's got some nifty scripting functionality that you can do with it. It's, again, incredibly powerful tool. And they would, I think the NetBrain people would position the product as, you don't need Visio anymore, ever. You can just keep up with your network in real time using this tool instead once you've got it fully implemented. It's, again, quite the thing. So, Dominic, have you had any experience with NetBrain?
Yeah, I would say let's take a step back here. We have a lot of interactive tools which are vendor specific. Yeah, we have the Cisco Prime and HP IMC and Avaya Com, but most of them are working only with their equipment. They say they have third party support, but that is really not that what I am looking for. Yeah, and NetBrain is for me kind of phenomenal. It is multi vendor. You can discover from a lot of different vendors your networks, and it will put them all together. It do configuration backups as well on the same program, and you can just do some instant monitoring. Yeah, not the monitoring that you are doing on regular basis, but you can say, okay, I have these three routers, show me the interface statistics only on these three links. This is also integrated in NetBrain. So you are not looking at a static diagram, you're looking at something interactive. It can, for example, make a link red if you have some errors on it or something like that. So you have an interactive map that is changing, that if you change your network, it will automatically see that and can pull a new map for you with new connections. Yeah,
that yeah. You kind of reminded me. There's a rudimentary function like that called Network Atlas in SolarWinds package. SolarWinds will again let you build kind of a living map. It's nothing like the power of the NetBrain solution, but you can at least build an icon that's correlated back to an actual object, and it can do things like tell you bandwidth utilization on a link and that kind of stuff. Anyway, sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah, and most of the networks I have worked with are multi-vendor, yeah? It is cool to have everything from one vendor, then you have maybe the management solution from that vendor, but if you have multi-vendors, let's say the firewalls from a different vendor, the network gear and the access layers from a different vendor than the core layer, it gets really complicated, yeah? And NetBrain is capable of putting that all together and make you a nice map. But as you mentioned before, it is not cheap. Yeah.
No, not cheap, but well worth the eval, and they'll put the time into you as a potential customer to make sure you're getting the most use out of it and not just try to hound you on, you know, you're going to buy it. They'll actually put an engineer on the phone to spend time with you to make sure you get it set up properly and all that stuff. So yeah. they do try to do it right.
That is a real weakness of these tools. They make so much money from selling this software that they have an unlimited budget for salespeople to annoy the heck out of you. That is a weakness.
Yeah.
Which, again, in NetBrain's defense, I didn't have that experience at all. It was thank mercifully it was the other way. They would ping me every once in a while, but the process of the interaction I had with them was, well, let's get you on the phone with an engineer so we can show you how to use the thing and make sure your network is being discovered properly, so you're actually getting and you can do an effective eval and not have holes in what NetBrain has discovered. And then they just ping me periodically after that, as opposed to some other companies where they're just some salesperson just beating the crap out of you on the phone. You going to buy it? You going to buy it? You going to buy it? Oh.
And they have really a unique tool. I've seen nothing else that is multi-vendor like NetBrain. And this is something, if you want to go next step on the documentation front, NetBrain is something that you are looking for.
I'd agree with that. So what is NagViz? You had written that one down, Dominic, and I've not heard of that one before.
That is just a simple visualization tool for the Nagios suite, yeah?
Oh, Nagios, kill me now. Okay, go ahead.
It is kind of the poor man's choice, yeah? It is completely open source, yeah? What I do a lot of times is I put in a Visio map on my Nagios, yeah? And then with the NagViz visualization tool, I can do all the links in real time, yeah? You pull every minute, and then you get a status about the link utilizations. You can pull in all the boxes that you are monitoring and see all the checks on each box. That is not the comfort that you have in with NetBrain, but you can pull in simple and easy your Visio map into something interactive, yeah.
Where you goes back like the sounds like that Network Atlas app in SolarWinds again. Yeah, similar kind of a thing. Yeah. You get, and again, right, a map that's giving you live data because it's taking the SNMP data that's polling periodically and then populating the map with that. So it's not exactly real time, but pretty close to real time as often as you're doing a poll, giving you that visual representation, an interactive representation of what's going on.
Yeah, when I draw a Visio, I always try it to lay out it so that it is easy, can be implemented into NagViz. So at the next time, I only want to look at the monitoring. I don't have to open the Visio. I only look at the interactive map, and all the important informations are already there. If something happens, the first step would be looking into the monitoring, and then I have the documentation on the same view.
Greg, any parting thoughts on interactive tools or anything that we've talked about in this show?
Some of this stuff is going to be taken over by SDN at the risk of banging the SDN drum. Quite literally, we're starting to see the rise of SDN platforms that have graphical consoles. So the old days of doing show IP root and having to do the mental translation of this, you know, 10.10.10.20/24 is Udna data in outer New South Wales, is kind of coming to an end. And SDN means that a lot of these, some of these tools are going to start to die as SDN platforms fold them in. So simple network diagrams will actually just be part of your SDN platform. So I would not overcommit to any network management platform. If you don't have one today, build up modestly. Start with open source. Build up muscle and you know, get cuts, learn hard lessons, build up muscle around what it's like to run servers and to run in low-cost environments, and build up your career at the same time, let's be honest. And then take them. And so that when you get to the point where you need more than what the open source tools are giving you, because ultimately open source is often limited or not what you want, you'll then be well prepared to go and buy network management tools. You'll have all of these experiences of tools, and you'll know what worked for you and what didn't work for you. And then when you go forward to spend money, you'll be spending that money wisely and on a basis of experience.
Dominic, same question for you.
I see with overlays and virtualization, even more documentation is needed, yeah? Maybe you have a centralized controller, it has an overlay network or anything else of SDN technology, but then you have an underlay. You still need to know what are the interfaces and so on. I see some value in a centralized controller, but it will not make all the documentations that you need to troubleshoot your networks for you.
And I'll just throw out there, I'll reiterate a point that we made early on, which is remember who you're doing the documentation for. And the most important person you're doing the documentation for is you. So when you don't do it, you're the one that's going to suffer the most, because it's what's going to help you the most when you have challenges and issues that come up. And whatever, you know, my take on the future here of SDN and all that stuff, that's coming and that's happening, and that is having an impact. In fact, I'm putting the finishing touches on an SDN WAN white paper that Packet Publishers is going to be publishing pretty soon. And that's one of the big elements that's in there is all the analysis and reporting of the data that's going on. It's a form of self-documentation that happens because that central controller has so much knowledge of what's going on. We're seeing that in other SDN platforms as well. But that is coming. You know, that is something you maybe haven't bought yet and maybe aren't going to be buying anytime soon. And so what do you do today, I think is the question. So whatever it is that you do today, you got to do it with that eye to the future, as Greg was pointing out. Why don't we wrap up this show? We've been going on for just about 90 minutes. My word. Did you guys make it to the end? If you did, you're all troopers. Let's start with Dominic and go around the table one more time. Dominic, I know you're, again, slightly anonymous, but is there a way folks can follow you, your secretive nature on the internet or a blog or anything?
Yeah, I just started in January a blog. It is called networkautobahn.com. And my Twitter handle is also Network Autobahn. So I put it in already some posts coming up more in the future. And hopefully you check out my blog. Yeah.
Okay. So Network Autobahn, as in the road we would have in Germany, that kind of a thing.
Yeah. Network, do we have 1 minute more? Just a little short story. Yeah.
Yeah. Go for it.
I had a major case here, and it was really bad, yeah, and the customer was really important, yeah, and they flied in the engineer that designed this system, yeah, and I picked him up at the local airport here in Berlin, and we were in a car, and I drive to the Autobahn, to the German Autobahn, and we have no speed limits. So I drive 240 kilometers an hour. And he was really scared, yeah? He said he was never faster than 65 miles in his life, yeah?
And 240K? What were you driving that could even go that fast?
Yeah, and so Network Autobahn always go fast here, yeah, in Germany, and that was kind of in my mind when I created the blog. It was inspired by my friend Michael McNamara. He was blogging a lot of Avaya stuff and stopped that recently, so I tried to continue that a little bit. Yeah. A lot of SPP stuff in my blog, yeah.
Ah, good news.
Perfect. And Greg, how can folks follow you?
You can follow me on my blog at Ethereal Mind and on the Twitter is at Ethereal Mind there. One thing, I do have a book about drawing diagrams in Visio, which I would, you know, you can buy it. It's less than $10. Sold 500 copies. People have liked it. I've only had one refund, and that's but it basically gives you a bunch of tips on how to use Visio to do diagrams. I wrote it 3 or 4 years ago before I abandoned Visio completely, mainly because when I went to people's sites, people were doing Visio diagrams. Just I watched one guy take 6 months to draw a bunch of diagrams, and I just thought, wow, how pointless was that? So I had to write this just so I wouldn't have to show him again. That's what it's for.
And I am Ethan Banks at EC Banks on Twitter. My blog is ethancbanks.com. This, of course, has been the Packet Pushers podcast, which you can find all about at packetpushers.net. By the time you get this, hopefully we've rebranded our website and it looks all pretty now and got logos, and we're going to be launching our subscriber platform fairly soon, and so on. So if you have any questions or comments about the show, you can tweet at us at packetpushers or send us an email, packetpushers@gmail.com. Last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.